Welcome back to the Dime Comic Bros podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Spencer. I'm joined by Jacob.
Eh.
Yeah, say hello. It's like Alcoholics Anonymous.
I'm a comic that might cost more than a dime. Come meet the brothers who are here to waste your time.
Jacob is on the road, so any apologies for any potential technical difficulties we have. We are still, despite doing this for almost four years now, we are still not good at this at all.
Yeah, it's pretty disheartening.
Yeah, it kind of is. So this topic, I've actually been looking forward to this one. So this week we're discussing the first half ish of the Guardians of the Galaxy by Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning omnibus. So this is the 2008 basically reinvention of the Guardians of the Galaxy as we know them today. They were originally introduced in the 60s or 70s by, I believe, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, but they were completely different characters set in the future. It was really disconnected from the ongoing Marvel universe. And then, you know, some stuff happened. The Annihilation and Annihilation follow-up event, whose name I don't remember, happened in the mid-2000s. And then
I think it's the War of the Kings.
War of the Kings happens during this book. It's Annihilation, and there's an Annihilation sequel or something. I don't remember what it's called. They're both really good, though, from what I've been told. I haven't read them yet. But out of that formed a new Guardians of the Galaxy team, which is mostly what we would know of them as today. And particularly being mostly familiar because of the Marvel Studios movies, it reads like a textbook, because any group dynamic that people pretend to know about from the Guardians probably was out of this book. So we're discussing the first 20 issues or so. It's the first three trade paperback collections of this run. A whole host of main artists, but primarily Paul Pelletier, Brad Walker, Carlos Magno, and Wes Craig. And then
that's something I wanted to hit on early, is that the artwork is really, really good.
I agree. The first trades worth, the first seven issues, or the first six are in the first trade, but the Paul Pelletier section is the best I've ever seen this team look. I was floored by how fantastic it looks. So it does have a rotating lineup of artists. We're going to talk about the second half of this omnibus in a month, because it gets a little messier from here. But we just wanted to split it up into more digestible chunks. So
I think it's funny that we say the artwork looks great, but in the first issue or two, Gamora jumps into the way of a great big fire blast and like burns away all of her skin and hair and everything and looks ugly for like the first trade's worth. It's really funny, but it's also kind of cool how it shows issue by issue how slowly everything grows back. She's got wicked short hair and then it gets longer and longer. It was really cool to see.
So just to
also
to lay the groundwork to lay the groundwork for the story real quick, because this is like every Guardians story is basically influenced by this. After the Annihilation wave, which was a Marvel event, a bunch of shit happened. It's a big cosmic thing. Like every universe fell apart and whatever. The Nova Corps got wiped out. And then a group of basically leftover characters from a bunch of different random solo runs that were in the cosmic corner of the Marvel universe are all convinced by Peter Quill and Mantis, as well as Adam Warlock, who are like all friends, basically, from those previous events. Peter Quill and Rick Ryder Nova have a very strong relationship from that event in particular. And they decide to make a team as a preemptive strike force, basically. So instead of like the Nova Corps are like, they're like the Green Lanterns. They're like space cops. But they come in after stuff starts happening. They want to make a team to fix problems before they get going. So they're the Navy SEALs of Marvel cosmic characters. And the first arc mostly deals with it turns out Peter Quill and Mantis lied to the entire group and basically brainwashed them into making the group. And then a lot of other shit happens. As you were saying, sorry.
My last note on Gamora is that it really cracked me up that they used the horny outfit through the whole book.
So I had remembered hearing a lot of things about how in a lot of the Guardians books, the women are extremely sexualized, which is true. But I think this book is the best example of it, or best in quotations, because Gamora is wearing like nothing through this entire book. She's one of the only characters who is dressed as such. But you see like 85% of her ass cheeks in every panel of this book. It's,
it's impressive.
It doesn't necessarily feel gross. It just feels like there was a reason for this that I'm not aware of. Especially when contrasted that too. Especially when contrasted with a lot of the other female characters in this story. It's a very horny book. It's in space. Everyone's having sex. It happens. But even like in comparison to Mantis, who is fairly well dressed up for most of this run, or at least this portion of the run, other than one incident where she doesn't wear clothes. That's a whole thing. It's just weird. Like, it stands out because it's almost entirely just Gamora. I'm wondering if there might be a character history involved in that I don't know about.
I want to say that I like the issue where the moon dragon is awakened, but it has a lot of leftover stuff from before where the character lost the moon dragon. And it uses a character that I don't know, a villain that I don't know at all. He just kind of pops up and makes it difficult for them to have the dragon or whatever. I don't know. It's 50-50, like really, really good and really confusing. Like, what am I missing here?
So that's actually my biggest positive of this run. When we were talking about the other Guardians of the Galaxy runs, a lot of what detracted from them was just not understanding all of the characters' history together, because a lot of these characters have been in these runs since effectively the beginning, like 2008. You have Phyla Vell and Moondragon, who are a couple, and then Phyla Vell is the daughter of... Is it? Yes. Moondragon is the daughter of Drax. And there's a bunch of backstory there that even in this is not really explained. I know all of these characters had solo runs before this team was formed, and I definitely want to get into those. But I feel like this run goes through enough of it that I actually understand that dynamic. I think it was the Al Ewing run. I had mentioned that it felt like those three, Moondragon, Phyla Vell, and Drax, just kind of were there. And because of all their interpersonal drama that I didn't have context for, it really detracted from the book. I feel like this book, even though it doesn't give you all the context, it's a lot better at making me give a shit.
I would agree with that.
Especially because, right, like you said, the second trade, so like issues 7 through 12 or so, deal with Moondragon sacrificing herself and becoming basically the entity of evil or whatever the fuck. Like the moon, the dragon of the moon takes over her body and stuff. And I actually cared, which was something in the other runs I didn't care for these characters. Like, they're fine. I wasn't invested. Whereas in this run, they give enough context in the beginning, mostly due to like really, really exposition heavy, like, fronting. Like, if a bunch of shit happened before an issue that you wouldn't know from reading the previous issue, this book will just tell you. Like, there's a full page in the beginning of this book that just describes why these characters know each other, which really, really helps, because, you know, it's clunky, but when the entire book is based off of a team's chemistry and like backstory with each other, it's really necessary.
My last thought on this is that this was the second omnibus I ever read. And at the time I read it just as a book. I didn't know anything about anything. And I really, really enjoyed it. And since then, I've read the first 40 issues of the Guardians run, like when they first started. I read that omnibus. So now that I'm going back to this one, it's way more interesting because all through this run so far, the first half, there's a character that's saying something's wrong. This isn't how this is supposed to happen. And it turns out that a lot of the OG characters from the first issue even are back in this story. And it's a weird remix. It's a weird timeline twist, I guess, where it's using those characters in a different story. So it doesn't feel like telling the same story twice. It feels like modernizing those characters or just bringing them into the quote unquote modern day. And it's a lot of fun. And with the amazing artwork, it makes those old school caricatures way more interesting and fun.
I agree. That was one of my other very big positives was from this was, through the first half so far, a lot of the events, the background, like the big plot going on is about how they're kind of stuck in like a time loop, but it's an incorrect one. So there's characters getting displaced in time who are like, this is not how this was supposed to happen. Like them taking the name, the Guardians of the Galaxy, is because they're aping it from the future characters. Like the original run was in like the 31st century or whatever. And because of fucking wibbly wobbly timey wimey shit, they know about this group and they're like, that's a cool name, we should use that. And then the two groups start clashing and it's really, really cool because I don't feel like I need the backstory of those characters to understand what's going on. It's very, they give you enough information in each issue about the characters and the archetypes that they fill, so you kind of understand the group dynamics. And they're not afraid to just say what is going on. Like most of, I think, usually a trope I don't like is when there's like the you know, in mockumentary TV where you have like the side interviews, like The Office, where you have the actual stuff happening and then it'll cut away to a character like telling you their feelings. I usually don't like that in comics very much. Heroes in Crisis, I think, did it really well. But here, it's a very key part of how these stories function is like every other page, a character is giving you a summary of what the last mission they were on was and how it made them feel. And it's framed in the story as like an after mission recap therapy session with Mantis. And I debrief. Really like that. It's so seamlessly transitions between, you know, the mission and then the recap, but you're being told the information at the same time. So you'll have,
And it usually works well with the humor too.
This book is fucking hysterical. Like they'll have, I don't know, something goofy happens because comic books. And then in the debrief box in the upper right-hand corner of the page or whatever, Rocket will be like, yeah, that was fucking gross. I don't like that. It sounds, so many of the jokes in this seem childish, but they're fucking hysterical. Like literally someone says there's organisms spawning out of the pustules on its tentacles, and Rocket's like, those are my least favorite words. And that's the sort of shit that usually gets on my nerves because it's very too tongue-in-cheek for my taste. But because this entire group doesn't work together, like they're not a good group of people. One, they're all shitty people. And two, they kind of all hate each other.
And that's
feels
something
like
the movie's forced and never, it didn't feel like they nailed it in the movies, but this book really does it well.
I hate to say that the movies didn't quite nail it, but I do agree. In terms of like, this group is constantly breaking up. Like after every other mission, they're like, we're not friends anymore. And then instead of the issues, like just taking a break or whatever, it will then follow the groups of characters going on other missions and then how they all connect together, and then the team reforms. And I didn't have any trouble keeping up with this. Like, I like to think I have pretty good reading comprehension, but when it comes to reading an omnibus, especially from Marvel during the mid-2000s, where there was an event every 4 seconds, I understood everything, or pretty much everything, going on in this book. It gave you enough context at the beginning of each issue of, like, this is what you missed, and this fills in the gaps. And also, a lot of the stories just happen in this book, where, like, like you said earlier, the War of the Kings and then the War of the Realms events, or something like that, happen in... Yeah, I think it was like 2009, and half of those stories are just, they're in the Guardians of the Galaxy book, so I have enough context to understand what's going on. It doesn't need to include the whole event for me to get it.
A quick spoiler, the overarching story heavily involves the Universal Church of Truth, and I thought for sure Guardians 3 was going to use that, and I was so excited because this it's such a great story. I really enjoy how this book wraps up, and I'm excited to cover it next month.
It is so funny because, like, yeah, every time we talk about the Guardians, you're like, is this one going to have the Universal Church of Truth in it? Which is true, because they're like,
seriously,
it's probably their second most important, like, group of villains. They're in most of their stories,
and it was the villain in the game too.
Yeah, and they're done really well here. I like, in a similar sense, when I think I was talking about the Al Ewing book, it really nailed the dynamic between, it was Nova, Peter Quill, and Gamora. Whereas in this, because of where it takes place in these characters' histories, it's a lot more Peter Quill, Gamora, and Adam Warlock. And it never feels so drama-y. It's like, yeah, these people have history and they've all had sex with each other's exes and whatever. But, like,
the word you're looking for is dramatic.
Yeah, whatever. But, like, it really nails the fact that these people went through a war not that long ago, and they are all really fucked up. And instead of having, you know, mostly intelligent emotional responses, they're all just, like, closing off from each other and getting angry over things that they shouldn't be, and they're all keeping secrets from each other. But it never really feels contrived. Like, oh, well, that character wouldn't do that. It's like, yeah, no, Drax would try to kill everybody for a plan and not tell anyone. Like, that feels right. This is, I think, the first... So as the first chunk of this book, I think it does taper down a little in quality towards the middle sections because of all the ongoing events. They're still really good, but I do think it gets a little caught up in... not enough, not screen time, but, like, enough issues necessarily to go through what it wants to. Like, Adam Warlock is a bad guy now towards the end of this, and it's resolved in, like, 2 issues. And it feels like that would be, like, the finale for a run, but I'm sure that the rest of the book will kind of give greater context to it. It just, the first 6 issues is probably the best Guardians of the Galaxy book I've ever read. Like, hands down. I was floored. I'm really excited to finish reading this. Like, I've been, yeah. I put the bookmark in it, and I've been itching to get back to it because I really want to find out how all of this comes full circle. it's so good.
I don't have any more thoughts on this. Do you?
I'm not really. No, it's just rare. Usually, and like, reading an omnibus usually has the same experience. No matter the size of the omnibus or who it's by, there's always, like, it starts off really strong and it does dip in the middle because of a lot of other stuff going on, and then it wraps up really strong. But, like, I was just laughing out loud reading most of this. It's really funny. Mm-hmm. It's really engaging. It looks fantastic, and it's easy to read. And for a team book that has, like, 12 main characters, that is an impressive feat. And even the more recent runs, which we have definitely enjoyed a lot, who have been done by very talented writers that we are very large fans of, don't quite nail it as seemingly, like, easily as this book does.
Well, I am going to move on to a personal topic.
You probably should.
I think it's that time. I kind of ruined myself. I kind of shitted myself in a way, metaphorically, when I jumped the plane to get here to my super secret location. I was excited to see that I could watch Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem for free on the airplane, and I did, and it was very good. But I wish that I had waited to watch it until it wasn't on a 4-inch square screen with shitty frame rate and 480p and headphone quality audio, because this is a really good movie. I can imagine how good it would look on an actual TV. The animation style is very fun. The same way that we described how it looked from the commercial, it does have that kind of muddy look that the OG TMNT comics had a little bit, but it moves really, really well, and it's colorful enough to be pretty to look at, but still kind of dark. It really walks the line really, really well of being... I don't know. It's got like muted colors. It's not like vibrant and colorful, but it has colors in it. It's not muddy and gross.
I think the way that I described it when I talked about it was that the world is gross and grungy and muted, but the characters aren't. The characters pop.
And they do a lot of really cool lighting effects too, like the cell phone glow as someone's looking at it, or things like that. It's really, really good. I cannot wait to see it again. The vocal acting actors, whatever, the acting is really, really good. Spencer had described it as it's literally a bunch of teenagers sitting in a circle, like shit talking each other. And I was like, I don't know how that can translate well, but it just felt natural. It felt like these couple of dorks were running around town, just shitting on each other and having a great time. It was awesome.
Making a good cheese.
The guest star voices, the commercial went crazy naming every guest star. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's nuts. How are they going to fit all those people in there and not be like Thor 4, where John Cena suddenly shows up and you want to throw a tomato? Like, but again, it was really good. I had to look up like, why does that voice sound familiar? Oh my gosh, all of these characters that just showed up are somebody that I know. And I missed all of them. It's very well balanced. It's a lot of fun.
They turned Rose Byrne into a crocodile.
Legit her worst role.
Boy, yeah, Mike.
I will probably re-review this when I rewatch it.
I think you should. It is, I think, still in my top five of the year, like all movies.
I have a feeling it will be in the top of the list this year. Your turn.
So on that note of movies that came out this year, I watched The Marvels like 2 hours ago. We've constantly, and a little probably too much, discussed general MCU burnout. A lot of their projects have been very
hit or miss.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't mean that all of their stuff lately has been very bad. If anything, like Guardians 3 and Loki Season 2 both came out this year, and they're some of their best projects. But it's the gap in quality from project to project that's really impressively not good. And this movie was not fantastic, but it was kind of fantastic. I walked in with pretty low expectations. I thought the trailers looked good. I thought the somewhat lower budget and I hate to say lighter tone, but lighter tone seemed appealing. It's like, I could use a break from all of this.
And short runtime.
Yeah, and short runtime. It's an hour 45, which Quantumania was like 2 hours and 15 minutes, and I wanted to die. And I was actually dying from alcohol poisoning that entire time. But like, yeah, this is not breaking new ground, but this, I was laughing in my seat, and I miss that feeling when it comes to a lot of Marvel projects. Guardians 3 was hilarious, but just the past few years on the whole have been a little dour, not necessarily because the movies are dark, but because they're not funny. And this movie was marketed like a comedy, and it is a comedy, and it's fucking hilarious. The movie lives and dies on the chemistry of its three lead actors. Which isn't to say that like your movie should only live on the chemistry of your actors, but like even in like phase two, we were describing a lot of Marvel movies as like, okay, they're not always great, but it's always fun to watch the actors riff off of each other. And that's what this movie felt like. It was three really talented people in a room doing a butt ton of really funny jokes and really well done fight choreography. I was very impressed. Ms. Marvel, Captain Marvel, and Monica Rambeau, who still doesn't have a superhero name, have been entangled quantumly, whenever they use their powers, they trade places, and it's used really well in the movie. It's not just a gimmick; they actually integrate it into the fight scenes really well. It's not like we're watching Daredevil fight scenes here. They're big superhero punchy space lasers and shit, but like, it's really well thought out. I was pretty impressed with the visual front. The visual polish, on the other hand, was definitely the biggest detractor. It does have the damn, this could have cooked for a while longer vibe. But I think that the actual camera work was really well done. It has the same syndrome that a lot of their movies have lately of like, wow, this was a very talented director who got kind of bullied by the studio into making the movie they wanted. But there's a lot of visual flair still here. Nia DaCosta is really, really talented. She made the most recent Candyman movie, which I really, really liked. So chock full of talent. It definitely got chopped up a lot in the editing room. Not like the movie was incoherent, but it flies by really fast. It integrates a lot of the characters from the Ms. Marvel TV show into the story very well. It feels like it's in conversation with that show, but not in the way that it's a continuation. You don't need that context. The movie provides it for you, which is well done. And it made Captain Marvel an actual character, which has been the biggest issue, is her first movie is fine. And that's the best thing I got to say about it. It's not atrocious, but it's really boring. And I really love Brie Larson, but it has felt, even in her appearance in Endgame, that she doesn't have a lot to work with. But in this movie, they give her character a decent amount of, I wouldn't say emotional weight necessarily. Again, it's still a comedy, but they actually explain her mannerisms and why she is the way that she is. Like the level of hot-headed stubbornness and emotional distance from other people is actually explained instead of you just, we'll figure it out. Like they just come out and say it. They're like, yeah, she's been in space for 30 years by herself trying to like rectify the sins of the previous bullshit that she did, and she doesn't have any friends. And like, yeah, it's clunky when you come out and say it, but it actually provides a lot of necessary context. She's really fucking good in this movie. There's not a lot of scenes where they try to pull a lot of emotional weight, but the ones that are there for me worked pretty well. And the three leads have really a really good dynamic between them because of their different levels of like personal history, you know, with Monica being basically Captain Marvel's niece, but she disappeared and then Monica grew up and whatever. Like they go into that pretty well here. And Kamala Khan's great. Iman Vellani is probably the best thing to happen to the MCU since like Robert Downey Jr. I swear. Ms. Marvel had its issues, but she is not one of them. She's hilarious. And the chemistry that they have together is great. There's a musical number in this, which I thought was really funny. It is supposed to be cringe inducing, but it was a good type of cringe inducing. And the costuming is really good. That was one of the things that really stood out to me, was despite a lot of pretty shoddy special effects, most of the costuming is fantastic, especially Captain Marvel. She has two outfits in this movie that are just fucking bangers. Like, I want to buy action figures of them. And I don't usually say that. Really cool. There's a lot of good cat jokes. I know, low hanging fruit. Oh no, cute kitty. But like, yeah, there's cute kitties all over the movie. I'm sorry. Fuck you. I like it. You know? It felt like watching Blue Beetle again. It was a very similar vibe I got. It's not reinventing the wheel. It's got some shoddy parts, but it was definitely a good blast. I would say it was a blast, which is a good pun. They also use Quasar's quantum bands, which is really cool. There's actually a strong level of like understanding of the Marvel cosmic stuff that they put into this movie that I didn't really expect to be so coherent. It's very digestible.
It falls in this phase, not counting Loki season two. Phase of movies.
Okay. So there's been three movies. It's Guardians, the Marvels, and then Quantumania. So if we're gonna go like, I guess rough
that's
category,
all we got?
we've only had five projects so far, and then we have Secret Invasion, and we have Loki season two.
So Eternals was part of the last phase?
Eternals was phase four, yeah.
Okay.
So I guess if I'm going to throw a number on it, like Guardians was like an 8 or 9. This is like a 6 to 7, and Quantumania was like a 2.
It got 2 whole points?
Out of 10? Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Quantum. Okay. I might be being generous right now. Like, this is like... it's hard to find a good comparison in the actual MCU. I don't know. Iron Man 3-ish.
I like that one.
I do too. It's not amazing.
Okay.
But like, I like cool. it. I encourage you to watch it. It's funny.
While we are still talking about movies that came out this year, I did my research for this movie because I was excited for this release. And then I failed to see it in theaters. Insidious, The Red Door, is Patrick Wilson's directorial debut. He's the dad guy, the dad character.
He has sex with Rose Byrne.
Probably not. But he used to in this world that they're portraying. Anyway, and it still stars Ty Simpkins, who's been along for the ride for the whole run of Insidious. This is the 5th movie in the series, I think. And I am proud to say that this is a dip back up in quality in the Insidious franchise. 3 and 4 were pretty rough and dropped off pretty quickly. Like, I think it was 4. It didn't even include these guys at all. But this movie goes back to the OG characters and deals with the fallout of Insidious 1 and 2. And I think it does it mostly pretty well. It's kind of boring. The scares aren't scary, but I like the base premise of like Patrick, the dad character, kind of went kooky and tried to kill his family. And this movie tries to deal with that because he was possessed or whatever. And what kind of emotional trauma that would have done to the family.
So you're telling me this is the Dr. Sleep of the Insidious franchise?
Yeah, I guess. Different levels of quality, though. We could argue about The Shining and Dr. Sleep all day long. But anyway, it's cool because the movie didn't end on a cliffhanger, really. I wanted to not like this movie because the kid character growed up and he's going to college for art stuff. And he has a bad dream and he tries to make the bad dream a physical thing he can touch by drawing it. And that's what reawakens his psychic abilities or whatever and starts making spooky things happen again for him and his family. And that felt indicative. Maybe not indicative. It felt similar to that time that Jason Voorhees was in a cemetery and someone. Okay, Zoom can suck my dick because it rudely interrupted me in a very difficult thought that I was almost all the way through. So editing this is going to be fun. I wanted to not like Insidious the Red Door because the child character has all grown up and is arting and tries to art a bad dream that he has, which is actually a memory. And that's what brings back the spooky things in this movie. And it felt very similar to one of the much later Friday the 13th movies when Jason has been killed. He's lying in a grave and some idiot stabs him with a metal rod and then Jason gets zapped with lightning and that's what brings him back. It's felt like the same kind of logic, horror movie logic, to bring back the spooky thing that they've already killed off. But this does a lot of emotional work with the kid that's all grown up and arting. And his artwork changes through the whole movie as he's exploring this memory or nightmare or whatever. And it leaves it, it concludes the story very well. It doesn't feel like a crappy horror movie cliffhanger. Ooh, we're going to do it again. It can stay closed if it wants to, or it can come back again. And I am happy with that.
That's good. Because, yeah, I remember the series pivoted pretty hard in 3 and 4 to, like, it's their third cousins. And it's like, what?
Yeah, it was dumb. It's not the greatest movie. It's probably a solid 3 out of 5 stars or 3.5, somewhere around there. But I'm glad that it ticked back up. It's a solid movie for a directorial debut.
That's good.
Good stuff.
The Darth Maul demon went a wooga booga 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 booga.
And he's back now, probably, maybe? I don't know. That didn't get answered.
Lipstick.
Your turn.
I don't love that series, but I do love that idea. Like the initial logic behind why that particular entity looks the way that he does. Yeah. It's Darth Maul, but like, I don't know. It sticks in the brain. So this is a very out of left field pick for me. But not really. So I was perusing Netflix, as one does when you're bored, and I saw a new TV series that's a detective noir-ish show with a bunch of actors in it that I like, and then come to find out it's based on a graphic novel. So it counts. Fuck you. Suck my dick. It's relevant. It is called Bodies. It is a crime/sci-fi limited series written and created for Netflix by Paul Tomalin. It is based on a Vertigo graphic novel of the same name, written by Cy Spencer and illustrated by a bunch of different people. The premise of this is super cool. So a dead body is found in Long Harvest Lane in England, which is a part of Whitechapel, which is where Jack the Ripper may or may not have happened. And the body is found in 4 different time periods, an identical body with exactly the same markings, wounds, everything. And it's found by 4 different detectives, one in 1890, one in 1941, one in 2023, and one in 2053. And we follow those 4 detectives, basically from the same police department, coming together to sort out what the fuck happened. It starts off pretty... I want to say grounded, but it sets itself very well in its settings. It's, I wouldn't say historically accurate, but it does take a good amount of time to set up some thematic through lines between all of its main characters. It's set in England, so there's a lot of British politics and British tasting racism going on and stuff like that, which I thought was really engaging. And because it's British racism, it has no spice on it. So we follow D.S. Charles Whiteman from 1941, who is a Jewish American who's living basically undercover, like using a false name because the Holocaust is going on. And Americans were still very anti-Semitic during World War II. So he's basically lying about his existence and pretending to not be Jewish. We also follow DC Iris Maplewood from 2053. She is, you could sort of say, the main lead for the show. She's the future protagonist, who's in this dystopian Blade Runner-esque world. And then we have DS Shahara Hassan, who's from 2023. And also 2053, who is the actual, I would say, lead protagonist of the show, because, you know, she's in the current time period. And then we have Alfred Hillinghead, my favorite of the four, who is from 1890. And they all, the time travel shenanigans in this thing is insane. So instead of it being a, we gotta find the time machine and we gotta butterfly effect and blah, blah, blah. You can't, when you're doing time travel stuff, you can't really get away from cause and effect questions, but this show actually handles it really intelligently from where I'm sitting. The main thematic through line is there's a certain character who I will not spoil, who is in all four time periods because reasons, and there's a lot of historical records and literal records on vinyl that the characters listen to in different time periods that explain a lot of what's going on. Between 2023 and 2053, there's a major cataclysmic event in England that kills like 500,000 people, and it's the foundation of this new dystopian world where everyone is loved, is the through line. It's obviously not accurate because, of course, it's a dystopian world where nobody's actually loved, but whatever. Usually time travel shit kind of bugs me because it's such a great concept and most things just go back to very basic time loop stuff. And as this show goes on, one, it has really intelligently done detective work from all of its leads, including very time period-ish accurate versions of detective work, just very different ways of going about finding information, which I thought was really cool. And the way that this layers the information that you know is hypothetically the most important part of a mystery in general for me. And the amount of times during this show, it's only 8 episodes long, where I went, wait, fucking what? And then something would happen and it distracts from the new information that I just got was insane. It's not clickbaity or like bullshitting you. It's treating the audience as fairly intelligent, and it's actually layering a lot of mysteries on top of each other that all end up coming full circle, and not in a way to me that seems overly contrived. Obviously, it's a time travel story. Shit's going to be contrived. But for the most part, it actually feels really well thought out and very well paced. When you have four main protagonists coming to similar conclusions at the same time, but through extremely different methods and very different plot lines, it actually feels cathartic when, like, say, one of the lead characters finds a new fact that you, the audience, was aware of ahead of them because you saw another character figure it out in a different time period. And the way that they all end up, like, basically communicating through time is fucking awesome. All four of the lead performances are absolutely fantastic. Kyle Soller is Alfred Hillinghead, and I do think he stands out from the lead four as my favorite. He was, I don't even remember the character's name, but he was the lead whiny bitch baby in Andor, and he's fucking killing it here. And the main antagonist, one would say, is Stephen Graham. He's a British actor who's extremely well known, and he is the Rizzler through this whole thing. The charisma oozing off of this one man who's in four time periods in very different life circumstances is fucking awesome. Visually speaking, it's pretty good. There's some wow look TV doing a green screen explosion, whatever, who cares. For the most part, it's shot a lot on location, and a lot of it was actually shot in Whitechapel, which is really, really cool. So they're on the same sets or the same streets in real life, but they will dress the street up like it's set in 1890. It's really, really fucking cool. This was an unexpected, like, massive win for my year. I've had a pretty rough year in terms of television I've been watching, and especially stuff based on comic book properties outside of Doom Patrol and Loki Season 2. Everything else has been pretty shit. And this was... I didn't even know it was nerd shit, and then I saw that it was nerd shit, and it's fucking awesome. It's not Perry Mason, but it's pretty damn good. And I think you'd really like it. I think I recommended it while I was watching it. I might not have, but it's it's so good. Ooh, it made me feel things.
Do you know what else makes you feel things?
Jeff Lawrence makes me feel a lot of things.
I was just going to say money. Just keep it simple. But yeah, Jeff Lawrence and Caitlin gives us money.
Money makes me feel a lot of things. if you want to help support this show, we would greatly appreciate it. On our Patreon, we have a bunch of different cool reward tiers, or at least I think they're cool. We have stickers, bookmarks. We do shout outs at all of our episodes. And currently we have Caitlin and Jeff Lorenz, who we owe a big thank you to, as well as exclusive and early access to a lot of our content and a bunch of other cool stuff, art done by Colin, commissions, all sorts of cool stuff. So if you want to throw us a couple of bucks, we would greatly appreciate it. Also a thank you to our partners, over at Jetpack Comics and Games in downtown New Hampshire. Holy cow, I'm tired. Downtown Rochester, New Hampshire. Shop local, support your local comic shop, especially. They give us all our stuff. Well, I mean, we buy it, they don't give it to us, but you know, they're the best. The best. Also subscribe to our Substack. Jacob sends out a newsletter somewhat weekly where he does a recap of each one of our episodes, as well as all sorts of pretty pictures and stuff. It's just substack.com. Wait, no, I'm dumb. dimecomicbros.substack.com. There we go. Also visit our website at dimecomicbros.com, where we have a backlog of all of our stuff, as well as our sources from the news and a bunch of other cool, fun stuffs and things. Tune in next week for the news, baby.
Jetpack.
I said jetpack.
Did you?
Yes.
Okay.
I did.
We've been doing this for so long, I don't even hear you do the credits anymore.
That's fair. I don't feel myself do the credits anymore.
Seriously. Just become numb to it all.
Yep.
Tune in next week.
Yes.